Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Ryan Bennett, a tennis-loving Canuck living in Sydney, Australia. And you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and a very big thank you to Ryan, the Canuck living in Sydney there from our intro. I do wonder, Matt, if Ryan is one of those Canucks living in Australia that we were sitting not far behind throughout the Felix Auger-Aliassime Daniil Medvedev match, in whose energy was utterly irrepressible. I mean, they were going wild for Felix, pumping him up right the way through. And some of them were doing it wearing woolly mittens. There were two women in the gang.
Three.
There was a gang of three of them.
Mm.
There was a gang of about eight, I would say, with flags and, you know, all the paraphernalia, including woolly mittens, which they wore throughout. And I would like Ryan to know, or any of our Canadian listeners, whether that's a thing in sport supporting in Canada, woolly mittens. Because I was so impressed at their commitment. That was a long match, and they kept the mittens on throughout. I thought it would be mittens on at the start, pose for a photo, mittens off. But it was very much mittens on throughout. So do let us know, Ryan, and thank you very much for being a friend of the pod.
I could do with some mittens if anybody's got any spare here in Solihull. It's blooming freezing.
Mm. It was weird weather in Melbourne today. It was just sort of sticky and overcast. And for the second of the two women's singles semi-finals tonight, the roof was in fact closed. I got caught in another rain shower. I keep timing my forays out into the big wide world very badly. But anyway, our women's singles final lineup is set, and it will be the top seed, Ash Barty, taking on Danielle Collins of the United States of America. I think the 27th seed, but that number seems far less significant than the number next to Ash Barty's name somehow. And look, we'll have a full final preview for you in a couple of days' time. We will all know tomorrow, won't we? It'll have to be tomorrow because the final, of course, is on Saturday. So we'll have a full final preview for you tomorrow. We'll, of course, touch upon that matchup tonight, but we'll mostly focus on how they got to that final. But just to very quickly rush ahead, it's a final I'm very much here for.
Oh yes, I said to you that after Ash Barty booked her place after winning the first semi-final, felt to me like Collins was the more dangerous opponent for her in the final, but out of Collins and Świątek, and particularly when Collins started that semi-final playing so well, I think a big question mark over someone making their Grand Slam final debut is always how they're going to handle that occasion. And look, we don't know for sure, but I feel pretty confident that Danielle Collins is going to bring it on on Saturday, and that will make for a great match.
One of the safest bets in tennis, Danielle Collins bringing it, and that's why we love her. That's certainly why I love her. Let's deal with Ash Barty first, though, and how she made her way through to the final here for the very first time. 6-1, 6-3 over Madison Keys. She hasn't lost a set this tournament. She hasn't been taken to a tiebreak. The most games she's lost in a set is 4. I mean, the majority of her sets have been 1-love 2, frankly.
Only Steffi Graf and Monica Seles have reached Australian Open finals, losing fewer games to get there. Barty's only lost 21 games.
Crikey. And honestly, tonight, it looked like more of the same. It looked like more of players just not really having a clue of how to deal with her out there. I mean, okay, there were one or two moments of opportunity for Madison Keys, which she didn't quite take, but that's what Ash Barty and the very best players in their peak do to you. They put so much pressure on you that when an opportunity does come along, you feel like you've got to do something extra with it, and you're just unable to cope with the pressure of the moment. So my personal take on that match is that Madison Keys didn't freeze. She didn't sort of fail to cope with the occasion or the moment. She was just comprehensively outplayed and couldn't get any kind of foothold in the match.
I thought there were some nerves issues early on, but I think that they are exacerbated against Barty because of the type of ball that's coming your way. You just don't get any chance to get any rhythm or routine into your ground strokes. And really, the vast majority of players these days in both men's and women's tennis, one thing you do get is routine and rhythm, because people don't do that much with the ball that's out of the ordinary. Barty is a one-off in the game, kind of in a similar way that Federer was. Ooh, did I say that in past tense? But, you know, it had a feel of a Roger Federer night tonight to me, the way Ash Barty, and all the way through the tournament, she's just been putting on a show. She's just, it's not been dramatic. It's not been a fun time as a competition in her, watching her matches. There's been no feeling of jeopardy really about the result in any of them. And yet there's still been wonderful spectacles because of what she's able to do. And she's not even having to really adapt and show the other layers to her game if somebody starts to hurt her, because her plan A is just completely discombobulating all opponents so far.
On that, On Barty's game being completely different to anybody else on the women's tour, and the fact that it is discombobulating all before her, Craig Tizer, her coach, he was quoted as saying via the WTA Insider, this is, quote, "When you see who Ash has to play, you see them out there practicing someone hitting a slice backhand to them. It's probably a bit late the day before to try to get that right. If you haven't practiced it enough now, you're probably not going to get that right." Heck of a quote, that. Really interesting. Yeah. And where do we all stand on that? I mean, he surely is right. The logic holds there, doesn't it? That it is such a difficult shot to deal with, that you're surely not going to nail dealing with it the night before, are you? Even if you're an excellent crammer. But equally, if she's totally one of a kind and practice time is so limited in tennis, isn't it? You know, you've got an off season of about 3 days. Is it an economic and efficient use of your time to be doing practice sessions devoted to the Ash Barty slice backhand?
I think he's absolutely right. I think he has hit the nail on the head there, really, in terms of why nobody is able to cope with it. I think Keys said today she's played Barty before and the slice is better than ever. She said it's deeper, it's lower, and she didn't cope with it very well today, Madison Keys, the same way nobody has coped with it in this tournament. What surprised me a little bit, or maybe it didn't surprise me, but what I think players need to do when they face Barty is try and take the slice out of the game. And that, I think that's way easier said than done. But I was watching this match and my mind went back to Shelby Rogers against Ash Barty at the US Open last year. Shelby Rogers, I don't think, is as good a player as Madison Keys, but she's similar in that her plan A is hit the ball hard from the back of the court. And what she did, I had this memory of watching her come back against Barty in the US Open last year, and I felt like she moonballed to the Barty backhand and got it up really high, which is a much harder ball to slice, sort of forcing Barty to hit the two-handed backhand, perhaps, which I don't think is as good as the slice. And I went back to have a look at Sheva Roger's press conference after the match at the US Open, and Rogers came into that match having lost four times in the season against Barty. So she said, she was asked what made the difference that you managed to get a win. And she said, tonight, going on the court, I told myself I didn't want to lose in the same way I lost the last five times against her. I tried to do things differently. I mixed in some high balls. I was super patient with her slice because she's not going to miss one of them. In the second and third set, she raised her level. She's going to do that. She's world number one. But I was wanting to hit the ball harder and harder, find winners, because that's the tennis I like to play. But that's what she wants me to do, Roger said. So I redirected, I used some finesse, and I problem solved, and I started hitting more high balls, like I'm in the under 12, she said, playing defense. And she said it ended up working. And now, obviously, that is credit to Barty, because she's making players adapt to her. She's making them go out of their comfort zone if they've got any chance of beating her. And it's not surprising that Madison Keys, playing a Grand Slam final, didn't want to play a style of tennis that wasn't her comfort zone. But I think that's what Barty is making you do. I think she's making players have to adapt, because otherwise she's picking them apart. They can't deal with the slice. And I guess I just thought maybe Madison Keys, maybe she tried to do that today and just couldn't. And maybe Barty was just too good. But there does seem a blueprint there that Rogers sort of told everyone about. And I'm a bit surprised that no one has not tried it a little bit more, because these matches are running away from them quickly. And Barty is just lulling them into playing the style of tennis she wants them to play.
That is absolutely fascinating. I wonder if ego is a factor, and that's not directed at anyone in particular, but if you are playing a big match against Ash Barty, if you're playing in the latter stage of a tournament, you are, you know, by definition playing good tennis, because you've had to get to that big match. You've been winning, you know, with your game. So to then have to take the mental step of going, oh, but the game that got me here won't be good enough today. It won't be enough. Won't work. I have to do something completely different. That's quite an ego hit, especially in a sport where the trend, the psychological trend, is to say, I'm going to focus on my game. I'm going to bring my best tennis. I'm going to focus on me. And I totally understand that. You know, focus on what you can control, not what you can't, etc. You know, I asked Iga Świątek about Danielle Collins not sitting down at changes of ends today, and she said, oh, I didn't really notice because I'm focusing on me. And I get all that, but also this is a tactical game, a tactical sport. And I feel the same as Matt, you know, surely stones are being left unturned here.
I've heard a lot from former players, coaches, commentators, about how difficult it is not to play the sort of tennis you want to play, because that's the thing that feels good. I want to hit the shots that feel good to me, not the ones that don't, even if those might be the ones that impact the opponent more effectively. And that is, I think, a really difficult mindset to get into. My mind goes back to the example of when Andy Murray first hurt Rafael Nadal by trying to hit the living daylights out of the ball, which was completely anti what he'd done all of his career that we'd witnessed to that point, which was, I want to move him around and I want to play slice and I want to drop shot and do the things that I like to do. But the thing is, he was getting his clock cleaned by Rafael Nadal every time he tried to do that. So he did something completely different. And suddenly it was like this brainwave moment that he figured out that he could do it. And it must be such a risk in your mind, though, to do that in a big match like a Grand Slam semi-final, when you don't want to make a fool of yourself, do you? Either you want to hit the ball well. I want to feel like I'm hitting the ball well, but I'm actually losing all the points.
You don't want to be Gael Monfils in the US Open semi-final. That's That's it, isn't it?
Of 2016 against Djokovic.
Yeah. That's the template going wrong.
That's an example of it going the other way. And look, I'm absolutely not saying that if someone starts moonballing to Ash Barty, they're going to win, because I think there was a sort of mix of factors at play that led to Roger's winning that match. But I'm just interested that nobody seems to be trying it even. And because Barty's proving that the sort of current style that players are going in with, she's finding it pretty straightforward to deal with. She's raised her level so much that she's just picking these players apart. It is fascinating to watch the way that the slice is also a great defensive shot. That was a couple of times today. Keys really did nail a forehand, and Barty just sliced it back short, brought Keys in, and then picked her off at the net. And she can use it that way. She can use it offensively to sort of maneuver opponents around the court. It is such a good shot. It's sort of such quiet, total mastery of the game of tennis that Barty seems to have developed at the moment. And the way she's serving and rolling through games on her serve as well just sets her up for the rest of the game to flourish.
Well, in the final, she will be playing somebody who has beaten her before in Australia. Who knows how significant that will be, but I'm sure it'll be in the mind of Danielle Collins when she takes to the court on Saturday. Collins today beat Iga Świątek 6-4, 6-1. It was just in the zone stuff from Danielle Collins, that sort of purple patch match that, you know, we all dream of having one day. Every time you unzip your bag, you think, today could be the day. It's never the day. But for Danielle Collins today, it was one of those days. She was just brilliant. She, if possible, upped her level of aggression and intensity. Certainly aggression. There was some stats coming up, I think, certainly on the coverage out here, showing that she had added about 5 miles per hour to her average backhand speed. She was just absolutely drilling her shots with just supreme confidence and commitment, to the extent that Iga Świątek said after the match that was the hardest ball she'd ever faced in a match. She said, wow. Look, there are players that hit the ball harder than that in practice, but they usually take a lot off the ball in a match, you know, to rein in the margin for error. So, you know, I think of Collins as a big hitter. I don't think of her as one of the biggest strikes out there, but I wonder if she was just so confident and feeling it so much that she was hitting the ball as big as she possibly could and just trusting that it would go in and not worrying about margin for error.
Especially that backhand, because she's so confident with it. Mm. That is her shot. And Darren Cahill, who was there, I think, doing ESPN courtside coverage, he made a little cameo pop-up on Eurosport. And he said, look, after the first set, he said that the first thing Świątek's got to do is stop feeding that backhand. She's got to start going to the forehand more. And next thing you know, just as in the first set, it was 3-love in a blink of an eye, and the stats were coming up, and she was going way too much to the forehand, to the backhand rather, and just feeding that shot. And Collins was sitting on it, and when she strikes the thing, and often she'll go cross-court too, she'll give herself a maximum margin for error, hit it as hard as she possibly can, and it is like a catapult coming out of the racket. And you know, you're on the defensive, and actually that shot to the Barty slice backhand most likely will be a fascinating visual, I think, and to see where that ends up.
Iga Świątek's serve, I think, was shown up tonight. Look, we know it's not necessarily the strongest part of her game, and perhaps never will be a big weapon, but it was attacked viciously tonight. You know, Świątek was just looking stranded after the service delivery, and the fact that Danielle Collins was serving so well herself, it just, you know, as Świątek said in press, she just didn't really stand a chance tonight given all that. But I got the impression from what she said, impressed, she really knows she needs to try and beef up that serve. She was talking a lot about the fact that she feels there are a lot of areas she can improve of her game, in her game, and she's glad about that. She said, look, if there were no areas that I could improve, then that would be pretty bad news because I'd be losing like I did tonight. But, you know, it's going to be interesting what she can do with that shot, because I don't have the technical knowledge to know whether she needs to change the motion at all to get more out of it, or whether, you know, it just needs time and attention. I don't know that, but I do think it needs beefing up for hard courts. And I certainly think she is ambitious about having success on surfaces beyond clay. I also think she was not a step slow tonight, but just perhaps didn't have the energy to even try and match Collins for intensity. You know, I know probably not anybody can actually match her for intensity, but that's quite an intimidating and fearsome thing, I think, to have across the court from you. And Świątek looked sort of not up for the fight, really. Not that she wasn't fighting for it out there, she was, but, you know, I'm not sure she was bare knuckle fighting the way that Danielle Collins wanted to.
Well, they're different characters, aren't they? But I mean, I think the interesting thing with Collins is she only really dug into the massively vocal come on and let's go when she started to feel a bit of pressure towards the end of that first set, when Świątek was starting to get back into it, and she needed to just give it even another push of intensity and intent. Until that, and all the way through the match, including her celebration, it was marching back and forth and getting the job done. There was no histrionics. There was no massively emotional celebration. She wants to win this title. She doesn't want to just reach the final. She wants to win the damn thing. So she's just going about, right, how do I do that? I'll win points. This point, next point, job done. And it's very interesting to watch her. You know, she believes this is in her. She's proving it. Let's go do it.
Oh, she's a stone cold badass. Totally. She's super cool, I think. I know she rubs people up the wrong way. I know that, you know, there are suggestions that she's not the most popular in the locker room, but I think she's a good egg, really. I think she just is doing her own thing and not worrying about pleasantries, really, on or off the court. And I have an awful lot of time for her. She has scored 7 top 10 wins in her career, and 6 of them have been in Australia. She likes it here.
Wow, that is interesting, isn't it? And a bit more on that record against Barty. There's one win, as you said, in Australia. Some close matches. I was talking to the Australian journalist Matt Trollope, who was saying he thinks of Collins as a difficult opponent for Barty. You know, one of Barty's wins was 7-6 in the third in Australia, and he said that at the end of that match, Barty was pretty actually pumped up. I don't think she particularly liked the sort of in-your-face intensity of Collins in that matchup. Collins has also had a couple of close sets with Barty on clay before. It sounds like she has dealt with the slice okay in the past. Now, that would be a good test of the theory that Barty's slice is better than ever. You know, if Collins can't handle it, then maybe we'll have yet more proof that it's better. But yeah, I think that's the hardest possible matchup, really, waiting for Barty in the final. And I can't wait for it. I really can't. I don't think Collins is going to be able to feed on the Barty serve in the way she did with the Świątek serve, as you've outlined, because Barty's serve is so good in terms of hitting the corners, in terms of allowing her to set up the points, whereas Świątek's was sort of a bit of a sitting duck at times, wasn't it? That the way it just sat up. So that's a big adjustment for Collins, but just energy-wise and intensity-wise, that could rock Barty, I think, a little bit.
And occasion-wise, I think everybody knows how big a deal Ash Barty is in Australia, and I think nobody wants to upset her or upset anybody else because she can do no wrong.
I think Danielle Collins wants to upset her, David.
Well, and this is what I'm going to say. I'm not saying that Collins is going to be going out of her way to be the unpopular person in Australia, but she doesn't care.
Mm.
She just couldn't care less. She's just going to do her job, and she's going to try and beat her and win every single point, and that's the end of it. She's not in this for a popularity contest, and I think that there probably is a little bit of that in some of the opponents that Barty's faced, a bit like they used to be with Federer. You know, they used to be a little bit too cozy at times, I think, and I don't think there's anything wrong with going and, frankly, being a bit of a Medvedev troll, but, you know, making people a bit irritated by you, fine.
Bit of a Robin Söderling.
Do me.
Mm.
Mm.
He always took that attitude, didn't he, when he faced Nadal or Federer. Mm.
Mm. So did Marinko Matosevic, though, and that didn't go so well for him. He did the old...
you've got to have the game.
Did the old kicking over the water bottles.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ash Barty is not going to be the only Aussie in action on Saturday night, folks, and that is because the Special K's are through to the final. They beat Marcel Granollers and Horacio Zaballos 7-6, 6-4 today.
And not just because of them.
I'm getting there. And they will face the also Australian pairing of Matt Ebden and Max Purcell, who beat the second seeds Rajiv Ram and Joe Salisbury on the second court today in a match that was, I think, unfair to those two Aussies, scheduled it at the exact same time as the Special K, so had absolutely no crowd whatsoever. But anyway, they will get a crowd on Saturday for the All-Aussie final, the first All-Aussie men's doubles final since 1980, which was also the last time an Australian woman played in the singles final, and that was Wendy Turnbull. We watched the Special K's on the telly today, David. That is how committed we are to this podcast and keeping our listeners abreast of all the goings-on.
Yeah, what did we find? We found a slightly less, I don't know, show-offy, circusy match, really. I don't know whether that was because it was on the Rod Laver Arena. That was certainly Simon Briggs' impression that, you know, the crowd's just less on top of the court there than when they're on the Kia Arena. And honestly, that seemed to be the analysis generally, that they did make it a lot more about the tennis today, Kyrgios and Kokkinakis. Maybe that was because they were facing the number three seeds who hadn't lost a set, and, you know, they really knew that sort of 100% focus was going to be required to win it. But I must say, I thought they played very well. They served incredibly well. I mean, they're so hard to break, and, you know, they've both got good hands and things. And when Zaballos and Granollers did start fighting back in the second set, they they just about kept their heads. There was a racket smash from Kyrgios and a brief rant, but...
And apparently a finger to the crowd.
Apparently, but...
This was the toned-down Special K's, folks.
Yeah, exactly. But they then took them out, and I must say, that's a very legit win. You know,
both those are. Beating Ram and Salisbury for Purcell and Ebden, and Granollers Zabaios, who, you know, were very good singles players in their own rights, both of them, Granollers Zabaios. Granollers did get the shot of the match, didn't he?
He did, a sort of behind-his-back recovery shot off a smash. He somehow made the ball, and then Kyrgios hit his backhand into the net. It was, yeah, it was a sort of...
A consolation prize.
A consolation, exactly.
I am quite interested in how the narrative is playing out over their involvement in doubles. It's kind of being billed. I heard Sam Groth interviewing them afterwards, trying to ask them whether they might have just changed the sport as we know it almost with the last week. Now, I mean, it was the biggest crowd that I've seen in Australia. That particular doubles, it was a massive crowd, and I mean that they have shifted the singles off the TV and all the rest of it. And I do believe that they've brought in some fans that wouldn't normally be bothered about tennis, which is interesting and it's great on one level. But I don't understand the question really. I don't understand the point. Are we saying that Kyrgios and Kakanakis are going to now start targeting doubles? Is that going to be a thing? Are they going to start doing that rather than singles? Are they going to be part of maybe some sort of brainstorming with the sport to try to figure out ways that Kyrgios has managed to engage with a crowd that nobody else has got to yet? These are all things that could happen. I don't see just... This is a thing in isolation. Mm. This is a wonderful 10 days. Yes, everybody remembers it. Everybody will... Mm. But... Trying to make out that this is changing the sport because it can happen next week. I don't believe that's the case.
Not a tennis revolution, which is what it has been called here. By both commentators and by Nick Kyrgios himself, I believe.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, David. I think this idea that there's some sort of long term effect on this brilliant run that they've put together, I don't understand, because as you said, there's no other team out there that's going to start doing this. I think it is going to be interesting to see what Kyrgios does now. We were talking about this earlier. His singles ranking is going to be outside the top 100. He's going to need wild cards to get into events, and look, I'm sure he will get plenty, but he might not get them every week. I can't imagine him really playing qualifying of events. I think he's going to be relying on wild cards. But his doubles ranking, if they win, certainly is going to be, you know, around 50 in the world. I think he would be able to get into some draws. Look, personally, I don't mind the idea of Kyrgios the doubles player. I think in many ways that
me either.
Sort of suits him fine. A bit. You know, it's one of the things with Kyrgios that I've sometimes thought that his approach to tennis is actually a more relatable one than a lot of the top players. You know, it takes a ridiculous amount of commitment and lifestyle dedication to be a top singles player. And if Kyrgios hasn't quite committed in that way, that has sort of felt quite normal to me. But if playing doubles and having someone alongside him helps him to enjoy time on court, time spent on the tour a little bit more, he could be a good doubles player. He really could. I mean, he obviously. But I don't...
He'd probably enjoy it more.
Yeah, I think so. But I just don't know whether he's going to do that. And if he doesn't do that, then, yeah, what is the long-term effect of this?
Because the thing is, it won't always be this. Sometimes it'll be court 12 in Metz.
The interesting thing would be, though, if he...
Metz, which is in September, apparently.
Oh.
Yes, turns out I got that wrong. I meant Marseille or Montpellier, folks. But, you know, it would be interesting. I mean, Charlie Eccleshare, who has been a contributor of ours over many years and a good friend and now works for The Athletic and covers football, but he still follows tennis really closely and he still loves the sport. And he was remembering back to when he was at The Telegraph and interviewing Kyrgios and Kokkinakis and thinking that Kokkinakis's injury issues actually also hurt Kyrgios because it took away a friend of his. It took away somebody who could travel the world and just sort of make it normal for him a bit more. And I think that there's some truth to that. I don't want to make too many excuses for Kyrgios because I think, you know, I feel for him on a number of levels. And look, he's perhaps just not cut out, like Matt says, for what all these other players are doing. But we may have got more out of him if he could have had a lifestyle that suited him as well. And I just think, well, if he decided, okay, I'm just going to go where Thanasi plays from now on. I'm just going to go to the same tournaments. We're going to go to the same tournaments, hang out together. I'll play qualifying, but anyway, I'll play the doubles. Maybe tournament directors, this is one way it could change, tournament directors look at what's happened this week and say, right, well, if Kyrgios and Kokkinakis play my tournament, they will get a big show court every time they play because I can sell that. And it would be interesting to find out whether that might change attitudes because you'd still have to have I've long thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to have players having to play doubles and singles and then you could get big name players together and sell the sport that way. But that is perhaps a proposition that might work, but you'd have to have the tournament directors prepared to say, yeah, I want this and I'm going to stick it right on center court at 7 o'clock.
Interesting proposition. I wonder how long that would keep Kyrgios interested. I wonder whether it would feed the ego enough. You know, what if Kokkinakis starts having a load of singles success and he's just sort of, you know, on the sidelines and I don't know.
And that's why I think ultimately it's a couple of fantastic weeks. Remember them for what they are, but let's just maybe not try to make out that the game has changed suddenly as a result.
Yes, yes. We reject the posited tennis revolution. the only Aussies that were unsuccessful today, or Aussie, in terms of the match, was Dylan Alcott, who was beaten by Sam Schroeder in the quad wheelchair singles final 7-5, 6-love. This, of course, the much-hyped, much-spotlighted final ever match of Dylan Alcott's career. He was crowned Australian of the Year just a few days ago. And it was, you know, the script was written. The fairy tale ending was going to happen. And while I was sad for Dylan Alcott today, I was so impressed with Sam Schroeder because he was supposed to, you know, read the script. He's only 22, Sam Schroeder. He had lost to Dylan Alcott in 6 of their 7 previous meetings. He had the whole crowd against him. You know, it had the whole tone of the thing felt like a sort of testimonial that he was supposed to show up and pay tribute to Dylan Alcott and play his role, really. And he did all that. He's obviously fantastically respectful and admiring and grateful to Dylan Alcott for what he's done for the sport, but he also wanted to win today. He's, you know, the future of quad wheelchair tennis. Only 22, goodness knows how many slams he'll get. And it was, I don't know, it felt like a really nice reminder to me that nothing is a given in sport. Anything can happen. It was tough that it happened that way. It was quite awkward, actually, in the second set, that 6-love defeat. I think Dylan Alcott was quite stressed and tense, actually, which is entirely understandable. But it was lovely at the end. Dylan Alcott did the most wonderful speech. I think he had everyone in tears. You know, what he's done for the sport, for disabled athletes, for disabled people. There were a lot of them in the Rod Laver Arena today, and they were quite emotional hearing Dylan Alcott speak. I think a lot of people were, and you know, he's he's changed people's lives, I think, and I'm sure he'll continue to do so. So I think overall good news for both Dylan Alcott and Sam Schroeder today.
Yeah, I mean, he's so beyond tennis, isn't he, Dylan Alcott, in just about every way. And I love listening to him speak. And I hope that what I really appreciated is the way he and Tennis Australia have become integrated, and the tournaments generally. And it feels like that has worked, and that should continue. And actually, I do think it was somewhat fitting that this incredibly talented younger player was the bloke to beat him and take that final set pretty dramatically. I know it doesn't go with the narrative and all the rest of it, but kind of a hell of a baton to pass, isn't it? And the dominant player gets beaten by somebody who feels like he could be the next dominant player.
You've managed to say changing of the guard without saying changing of the guard, David. Wow. Points to you. Also today we had Dida de Groot beating Anik van Koot in the battle of the doubles partners, which is apparently not a big deal in wheelchair tennis, but we like to think of it as a big deal. 6-1, 6-1, that's her fourth Australian Open and 13th Grand Slam title. We had Shingo Kaneda, who beat Alfie Hewitt today to avenge his defeat to him in the doubles yesterday. Thriller, this one, 7-5, 3-6, 6-2. That is Shingo Kaneda's 11th Australian Open title going back to 2007 and his 20th Grand Slam title. And that's only singles, folks. He's got a whole bucket load of doubles titles as well. But his 27th Grand Slam title. Extraordinary. And in the women's doubles today, we had Barbora Krejcikova and Katerina Siniaková beating Kudermetova and Mertens 6-2, 6-3. So a second straight final for Krejcikova and Siniaková. They'll play Haddad Maia and Danilina. And they missed out in the final last year, didn't they? They just feel unbeatable, don't they? Siniaková, Krejcikova.
Yeah, that's a really convincing win over Mertens and Kudermetova, who are a very strong pairing themselves. They're some team, Siniaková and Krejcikova. And I think they benefit from always playing together, and they just know each other's games. And Krejcikova's got all this experience now of top singles matches, and they feel like they're getting stronger.
So what about tomorrow? We start on the Rod Laver Arena at midday with the mixed doubles final, where we have the Aussie team of Jamie Furless and Jason Kubler taking on Kristina Mladenovic and Ivan Dodig. Then, not before 2:30 local time, Matteo Berrettini against Rafael Nadal. And then the night session from 7:30 p.m, Stefanos Tsitsipas against Daniil Medvedev. What's going to happen?
Ooh, I was hoping you wouldn't ask that.
Well, I think we're in for two classics.
One by?
Epics. I'd probably go Nadal and Medvedev. But I think that Tsitsipas is going to bring it this time. I think he's probably learnt a thing or two from his match the other day and how that worked, which was just jumping out and trying to hit out. I think he tries to rally too much with Medvedev. And Medvedev's too consistent for him. And eventually Tsitsipas then tries to come to the net, and Medvedev is absolutely brilliant at passing him. I think he's got to try and... You know how you were describing the footwork, Matt, and he was bringing his forehand into play, Tsitsipas, even when... Normally, he would just stay and sit on the backhand because he loves hitting his flourishing backhand because it's a beautiful shot and he times it nicely and it dips down inside the baseline. And Medvedev just says, yeah, we'll do this all day long. That's absolutely fine until you drop one short and then I'll really go for it and take over. I just think that maybe Tsitsipas has realised that he's got to do an Andy Murray against Nadal and just go for it on the ground strokes and try to dominate. That will bring out the mongrel in Medvedev, which is never far from the surface. He will do what he did against Ozhe Aliassime. He'll force it into a fifth set, and then it's game on. I think Berrettini believes that he can beat Nadal. He really believes he can take him out. They had a close first set, the one other time they played. It was a tiebreak set, wasn't it, at the US Open. I think he had a set point. But Nadal won that in quite comfortably in the end. And I think there was a bit of the Berrettini against Federer in that performance as well. So I'm not sure I really deserve to share the court with this bloke, you know, deep down. Well, I don't think he feels like that anymore. I think he feels that he can take Nadal out. If Nadal's fully fit, I still bat Nadal.
He's bought you some time there with that answer, Matt.
Yeah, not much to add. I think I agree with David's winners. I actually listened back a little bit to the podcast we did last year after the Medvedev-Tsitsipas semi-final. They met at exactly the same stage at the Australian Open. And I was reminded by how one-sided that was. And, you know, what a Medvedev problem Tsitsipas had. Tsitsipas only hit two winners from the baseline in that match. He had no way past Medvedev. So I agree with David that he needs to do something different. He can't just trade with Medvedev. He needs to get that forehand into play if he can. He also didn't come close to reading Medvedev's serve. I think Tsitsipas's return is an issue, and Medvedev's serve is so strong. So I'm backing Medvedev, but their respective quarterfinal performances puts doubt in my mind just because of how good Tsitsipas was. In the first one, yeah, I'm backing Nadal. I'm interested what the conditions are going to be, you know, because we did see Nadal actually struggle in the heat the other day. It could be indoors. There's showers forecast tomorrow and sort of slightly stormy weather. So I don't know how that would change things, but yeah, I do back Nadal.
How do you think the back end will hold up for Berrettini against Nadal? I think that if he targets that relentlessly, I'm not sure that it will cope.
There's a zone for Nadal to hit to, isn't there? A sort of safe zone, which is the Berrettini backhand. So over five sets, can it hold up? Yeah, I'm not convinced either.
He is so good at targeting a weakness, isn't he? Nadal, it's assassin-like, ninja-like. I think he has a chance, though, Berrettini.
Oh, yeah.
I really do. And you're right, he's not pleased to be there. He's got fangs that I've been underestimating consistently, as we discussed yesterday. So I think he has a chance, but I'm edging Nadal, and I think I'm edging Medvedev. But I feel even less confident about that one. Tsitsipas was so good. But I know this sport is about matchups, so I'm going to agree with you both and just go for Nadal and Medvedev. But
so pumped for the Berrettini-Tsitsipas final on Sunday.
But the thing is, I would be. I think this is a cracking semi-final lineup. I think we really should have a cracking women's final on Saturday. There are other brilliant storylines as well. And Stuart Fraser, the Times tennis correspondent, quote tweeted a tweet of his from a few days ago and I'm sorry to bring this up after we've all got over the trauma, but when the court documents came out after Djokovic's final deportation hearing, of course, the documents weren't dropped until a few days later. And one of the arguments that Djokovic's defence team put forward was that the Australian Open and even Australia would be damaged by Novak Djokovic, the world number one, not playing in the event, and specifically that the tournament's future in Australia would be damaged. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear, in the words of Rafael Nadal, that no one person is bigger than the sport. This sport can survive and thrive without any one individual.
One of the many lessons that Tennis Australia, I think, need to learn from this whole episode is that they've always wanted to be player first. I understand that. I admire them, their success in that over the years. They've done an incredible job, but they've done it to a fault, to the point where, frankly, they lost sight of what was really important, most important, and I think this tournament has proved the point that, you know, I mean, look, it would still be better if Novak Djokovic was in the tournament, and I wish this had all never happened. But at the same time, it showed that it hasn't had Roger Federer. It hasn't had Novak Djokovic. It hasn't had Serena Williams. Of course, these names, these figures, these players elevate any event that they're in. But others have stood up and carried the baton, and the storylines have been wonderful. We'll find out about the viewing figures in due course, but it's been a great tournament.
Yeah, it has. I am pumped for the 3 days to come. I can't wait, folks. And just finally, one last thing to mention while we're on Tennis Australia, they did U-turn on the ban of Where is Peng Shuai T-shirts, and they are now allowed inside the grounds of Melbourne Park, which is absolutely the right decision. And, you know, that's commendable, because admitting you're wrong about something isn't very fashionable these days. People don't seem to do it. So that's a good thing. That is it, I think, for your Day 11 Australian Open Tennis podcast. There's only three more to go. I can't believe it. And, of course, a review show for Friends of the Tennis podcast. If you want to become a friend, then do it. There's nothing stopping you. There are details in our show notes. You can get an intro or a shout out, like Emily that we met today. Matt, we met Emily and her friend Nat.
Very lovely too was Emily. We were set up by Simon Briggs.
Yes, he said, "I've got some pod fans that want to meet you," and he sort of led us to an appointed location, and it was lovely. But it was all very mysterious from Simon. And apparently Emily got a shout out on US Open Men's Finals Day. Lucky Emily. That could be you if you become a friend of the Tennis podcast. We have our mascots, Carter and Darwin and Gerald the cat. We have Charlie. No, David, we're out of time. We're out of time. We've got Charlie.
I delivered for you, Darwin. You and me, Darwin. We predicted Collins in two, didn't we, Darwin? Yes, 40 points. Come on.
We have got Charlie. Don't talk over me talking about Charlie. Charlie deserves the spotlight. Charlie, our lovely beagle mascot. We love Charlie. Thank you to Phil and Gina for bringing Charlie into our lives. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. There is an all-time great Billie Jean photo currently sitting on our Instagram stories for a limited time only. So get yourself over there to see that photo. We have our executive producers and top blokes, Chris Albert Lee and Kyle Weingartner. And Matt, we have shout outs.
We have Nancy Dorr from Toronto.
Or Toronto.
All right, Nancy.
Hello, Nancy. I always used to love the name Nancy. I saw a school production of Oliver and decided I wanted to be called Nancy.
Uh-huh. One of the things I enjoyed doing yesterday was just asking people to take a photo of where they were listening to us. And somebody took a photo from Toronto in heavy snow. And I thought, blimey, that looks a bit nippy.
I think Toronto is a bit nippy at this time of year, David.
Mm. Yeah.
Anyway, thank you, Nancy, very much indeed.
We have Jeff Zahos.
Oh, Zed in the name.
He says,
I like that.
He says it's pronounced several ways, all of which are fine. Maybe you'll come up with a new pronunciation, and because it will sound British, it will be charming and delightful to my Yank ears. So really, I can say it however I like, by the sound of things.
Oh, there's there's some punctuation on the O. Is there?
I don't know. Anyway, right, Jeff. Jeff, and Jeff also has a dog, Benji.
Oh.
A 13-year-old white woodle, a Wheaton Terrier poodle mix. So we're going to have to request photos.
Do send us a pic.
Wheaton Terrier is quite rare, actually. I'm not sure I've ever met one in the flesh. I would
it's
love
minus
to.
Minus 18 degrees
love
in
to
Toronto.
Meet a woodle.
Oh, my word. There's a lot to take in here, suddenly.
Jeff, thank you very much for being a friend of the podcast. Please send me a picture of your woodle.
Yeah, you send us a picture of your Wordle. Right, who we got next, Matt?
We have Ada Pesh, who is a long-time friend, I believe, and she's in Zurich. She's a cat lover, and she's also the one who recommended an indoor hammock for Catherine. And your new flat.
I didn't go in the indoor hammock direction in the end, but it is a life goal of mine to have an indoor hammock, so I appreciate the recommendation. I've been to Zurich.
Me too. I went through Zurich when I went to interview Roger Federer back in 2001 in Biel in Switzerland.
Okay, that is better than my Zurich story.
Whenever I hear Zurich, I think of that Federer and Nadal video when they're trying to make an advert and they keep giggling because Nadal says, "See you in Zurich," and it really makes Federer laugh.
A bit like Matt in press conferences when Medvedev says volley. He can't control himself.
Just a lapse.
Thanks very much, Ada.
Because he says Wally.
He does. Serve him Wally.
Which, for a guy with V's in his name. Anyway. Anyway, thank you very much, Ada. We appreciate your support. Thank you to all of our friends of the Tennis Podcast. We'll be back with our Day 12 pod after the two men's semi-finals, which David has promised will be epic, tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.